Underwriting support for the Book Show podcast on WAMC.org comes from Northshire Bookstore, Manchester, Vermont, and Saratoga, New York. An independent bookstore offering books, author events, gifts for children and adults, and more. Northshire.com. And the College of St. Rose, Albany, New York, offering a master's degree in English with a concentration in literature studies and an MFA in creative writing. strose.edu/gradprograms.
Welcome to The Book Show, a celebration of reading and writers. I'm Joe Donahue. This is an off-the-shelf edition of The Book Show in partnership with Northshire Bookstore in Manchester Center, Vermont, and recorded before a live audience. Norman Lear is a legendary broadcast pioneer known for creating some of the most acclaimed and top-rated television series of all time. His iconic shows include All in the Family, Good Times, The Jeffersons, Maude, Mary Hartman, One Day at a Time, and Sanford and Son. Storylines in his shows address subjects that were not typically discussed on TV at the time, like racism, abortion, homophobia, class struggles, and politics. He has won 4 Emmy Awards and was inducted into the Television Academy Hall of Fame. He's also the founder of People for the American Way. He's just written an extraordinary memoir called Even This I Get to Experience. It is a great thrill, and I hope you'll join me in welcoming Norman Lear to The Book Show.
It's a real kick for me to be here because the bookstore has meant a great deal in our lives, as has Vermont. I should say Vermont first, the bookstore second. We have had a second home in, just outside of Bennington in South Shasbury for 30-some years now. It is a sacred place for us, and we love Vermont, and it's hard to express. But read the book, because some of it is in there.
The name of the book is Even This I Get to Experience. And what you learn through reading the book is that title has several different meanings, doesn't it?
Well, primarily it means even this. Look at this. I have half a dozen family members here. that could have been one of them.
I was thinking about this earlier as I was looking out. 250 people or so is about the audience that you would have when you would do a taping.
Yeah, 240-some people.
And the way you designed that was that, much like we are tonight, the stage would be here and the crowd would be just 20 feet away. Mm-hmm. And that was important to you.
It was important to me because I always thought of us as doing theater that was being taped. But it was theater. We very rarely went to a second set. We stayed in the Archie Bunker 704 Hauser Street set 99% of the time. And there's something special about performance in front of an audience. There was no laugh track. The only time we used the laugh track was to cover an edit. The actors have an opportunity to ride the emotions of the audience. So those close-ups that you saw of Archie Bunker, for example, it was the brilliant actor Carol O'Connor riding the emotions of the audience, so he would hold for that laugh or do something with his mouth that would increase the emotional feeling. And it was another kind of television and theater, basically theater.
The idea that it was theater also... One of the things that I noticed, a common theme in the actors that you got, Carol O'Connor, Jean Stapleton, Sherman Helmsley, Bea Arthur, so many were New York stage actors. That's where you drew a lot of your talent from.
Yes. I had a mentor. His name was Jack Rollins. He was a manager and an agent, but an independent one. He's still with us. I think he could be 95, 96. He took me around to theater, but I mean off Broadway theater. Every Rue McClanahan, every Conrad Bain, every Sherman Hemsley, I saw off Broadway someplace. There were agents who became major agencies, CAA, which is the biggest agency in Los Angeles. And the guys who invented it, who started it, loved to tell me how they used to hang around our shows and rehearsals because that's the way they would get these Broadway actors who didn't have representation in Los Angeles, and they would be signing up those actors.
Was it ever a tough sell to get those actors to leave New York, come to Los Angeles, and say, okay, I'm going to do this?
B. Arthur resisted doing her marriage was in New York. It wasn't going to move west. And her sons were there in school. That was very difficult for her, but she eventually, after having come out on the when I was doing the George Gobel show, she came out a half a dozen times and got a little bit used to it. And then when Maude came up, well, she did the one episode on All in the Family. And then it was easier to get her to come out.
That's an episode where everyone in the Bunker household is sick, and they need to get someone to take care of everybody. So they get Edith's very close cousin, Maude,
yes,
who is the polar opposite, for all extents and purposes, of Archie Bunker.
Totally. This is something I learned from my own life. I lived in a family that existed at the top of its lungs and the ends of its nerves. Yelling was a very big thing in my home, especially on holidays when everybody got together for Thanksgiving. Thanksgivings were giant fights after a good meal. So I wanted to do an episode on All in the Family in which somebody was strong enough to really belt Archie, to really give it to him. And I learned in my family that there was nothing like an old relative that had an old grudge. Somebody that was still steaming because 16 years ago, Gert wasn't invited to a certain wedding. And that person could pick it up from under the floor and clobber you. So Maude was that, as you described, Edith's great friend and cousin who hated Archie, didn't want her to marry him. So she came with an ancient grudge, and it was great. And casting B. Arthur in that role was, of course, a miracle.
Absolutely amazing. You write in the book that the show was airing in New York, the credits were rolling, and Fred Silverman was calling you.
Yeah.
The head of
the vice CBS. President of CBS was calling as the credits were rolling to say, that woman, there's a show in that woman. Well, we kind of thought so.
In casting Carol O'Connor as Archie Bunker, you read a lot about that process, that you knew right away that he was the guy. But you also write about what he had to really give up to be that character, to be the bully, to be the boorish guy that he was, what that put on his shoulders, which I found fascinating.
Well, he knew the character because he lived in New York, and there was a taxi driver who he mimicked to start with, whose sound he knew real well. But the capacity to play something 180 degrees from who he was, and in this case, a bigot, somebody terribly afraid of progress. That was hard for this Irish intellectual, and he was an intellectual. And he was frightened of it and eager to play it. I mean, it was a wild combination in him. And it made things very difficult and very wonderful for the rest of us in performance.
Two things I found interesting. One is that you mentioned the Irish background that he had. And you say in the book, there's a specific line in the book, that you didn't want to go there. You never wanted to identify him as an Irish Catholic guy.
Oh, I didn't know. I didn't want to be, because he was representing thought that every section of the culture would resist. Nobody wanted to be represented that way. So to make him a Catholic, to make him Irish, the network said, but that's who he is. You can't look at him and think anything else. But I said, theater is theater, you know? You ask an audience to believe what you ask them to believe, and if you're doing it right, they'll believe it. Now, we never talked about it and said, believe this guy is not Catholic, believe this guy is not Irish. But we played him that way. Yeah, the man was so brilliant, the last thing you thought of was that after you thought about it the first time.
The sidebar to that is the wonderful episode where he is baptizing his grandson.
Yeah.
So he was not labeled a specific religion, but he was a spiritual person.
Well, that's interesting. I haven't been there before. You know, to be married to Edith, if you never thought about it, there had to be some spiritual underpinning. And he was married to Edith, who was the essence of what you're referring to. So I hadn't thought about him, about how deeply he was spiritual, but as I think about it now, a connection with his, you know, when we did a double episode, I wanted to see what would cause Edith to lose her faith. There was an episode where Archie, driving a cab at night to make a little more money they needed, saved the life of a woman by giving her artificial respiration. He came home telling them that he had given mouth to mouth to this person, and this person lived. And a little while later, that person looked him up, wanted to come to the house to thank him personally. And she did, and she turned out to be transsexual. So Archie Bunker had given mouth to mouth to somebody he thought was a man. I mean, he would think when he knew it was a... Edith learns this first, and it was Edith's capacity, spiritual nature, to love the next human being like she loved every other human being. So she was already, she loved this person. When she learned who it was, when that person in a subsequent episode, 2 years later, the actor made several appearances, was killed a couple of years later for being transsexual. Was just killed in the street by a gang. She could not believe in a God that could see that happen. And she lost all of her belief. Now, we didn't know how to get it back.
Right. How do you get back your faith in a 22-minute episode?
Well, we couldn't do the first episode until we knew what the second episode would be. Clearly, she would lose her faith in God if that happened. But how she would regain it was a question that took weeks and weeks and weeks. I invited the philosophy department at UCLA to send somebody one afternoon to talk with us. I'm not sure it was then, I don't think it was, but after hours, countless hours of talking about what would it take for Edith to regain her faith in God, somebody innocently asked one day, wait a second, when she loses her faith in God, what happens to Archie? And that was the clue. He went to pieces. Her strength came from her faith, and he needed that. He could not exist without that strength. And so that's the way the second episode went. I'd like a little applause for that. Thank you. Thank you.
The other thing about Carol O'Connor is that you write that very early on you learned that it was going to be a difficult road. He would look at every script and you were going to have to battle it out.
And we did. And we did. You know, 7 or 8 years, was it 8 years we ran? Went by. And here's how that story ends. We had terrible times. And great success. I mean, you know, it was just a glorious mixture of everything you could get out of life. The misery of getting it done and the joy of having it succeed. But the story ends, he had died. We didn't have a social life together. I went to the house to comfort Nancy, his wife. There were a lot of people there. She asked me to wait till the house was empty, and I did. And then she took me into his den, and she opened the door. It was clocked, and he had a clean desk but for a couple of pieces of paper. And one of those pieces of paper was a letter I had written him 3 or 4 years before, in which I told him how much I loved what he brought to my life and to American families everywhere in that character, how much I loved him as an actor, how much I understood he loved Archie Bunker, the character he created. And the love overwhelmed the torment of getting the job done. Couldn't have been a more sincere letter. It was on his desk the day he died, just as it was every day from the day he received it. Mm. And Nancy wanted to share that with me.
In telling that story and reading the story in the book, I was wondering if, do you think he needed that to be able to pull that character off? He needed that friction with you?
It could very well be. I don't know. Whatever he did, the days he did them was what it took to get the job done. So from that standpoint, you could have a good point there, that he needed that to get the juices flowing.
There were days where he would say, I'm not going to do this.
Oh, no, there were days we went through lawyers and all that stuff.
Your lawyer, his lawyer, everybody.
Everybody was in the act. And the network, of course.
What's fascinating is that when the show comes to its natural conclusion, Mike and Gloria, Archie and Edith's children, they move to California. And you say, okay, this is a good place for the show to end. And here's a guy who's been fighting the entire time, Carol O'Connor, says, I don't want to tent.
Because he had an opportunity, he felt, if we allowed it, to do it his way. I didn't want it to happen because I loved the character that we created, and I didn't think he would do it justice without whatever it was I brought to it. And he did, I don't know, was it 3 years? Three seasons of Archie Bunker's Place. It was entirely his. I had nothing at all. I tried this. I didn't want it to happen. I went through all kinds of arguments about it. I gave in when my own attorney laid out a list of the people who would not be working next season. And so I said, let's go. And they did it. Every reason I didn't want that to happen can be seen in Archie Bunker's Place. It was a very good show. It was just not the Archie Bunker of All in the Family.
In the second season, Edith passes away, and it's the premiere episode of the second season. Edith passes away, and Archie goes to their bedroom, and he picks up her slipper, and he falls to pieces. You point out in the book that that is a scene that would have never taken place on your watch.
No, what I pointed out in the book was it was a scene that if I was there, there would have had to be a laugh in it that would make the audience even more empathetic. He did a wonderful scene. There wasn't a sound. And I think life is, the way I look at life, there's a laugh available in anything. But it doesn't mean you have lost the empathy. You've gained more.
When that show, All in the Family, exploded and became so a part of the American culture, it didn't have tremendous ratings at the beginning, but you started, not at the beginning of the season, but as a mid-season replacement, and because of that, were able to find that audience.
If it had started at in September, when the seasons usually started, the likelihood would have been it would not have been picked up. But because it started in January, by the time it was over, there were only three networks. The other two had ceased. Their seasons had ended a couple of weeks before ours. So it was a fresh, people looking at ABC and NBC now had their shows were over, the shows they were watching at that hour, and let's take a look at this show we heard about on CBS. So the ratings started to tick up.
From that point, very quickly, the show soared and became part of the fabric. It was still, with standards and practices, was still a fight pretty much every week.
Oh, yeah. Well, some wit once said, nobody ever lost money underestimating the intelligence of the American people. H.O. Mencken, I think, might have been the author of that. Not that the establishment, and by establishment I mean the people who run everything, this part of the culture, that part of the culture, believe that, but they believe something far less than I believe about the American people. We may not be the best educated in the Western world, but people are generally, they're heartfelt, and they can be reached emotionally, and there's wisdom there. We're not led by people who really feel that to be the truth.
What happened?
We are into something so bloody deep here.
But what happened? I mean, if you turn the TV on in 1969, 1970, you have Beverly Hillbillies and Petticoat Junction, which are all fine shows, they're funny. But then you turn on All in the Family, and this is something that is completely different.
They were fond of saying, after we were on for a little while, that I was sending messages, and messages are for Western Union, like I shouldn't be doing that. The shows were about something. It must have been a couple of years before I began to think, wait a second, Petticoat Junction, Beverly Hillbillies, those shows that preceded us, weren't they giving out a message? Mm. There were no race problems in America. There was nothing like abortion. There was no trouble in the economy. There was nothing going on except the roast was ruined and the boss was coming to dinner. That's all that was going on in America. Well, if that wasn't a floor-to-ceiling message, I don't know what was.
What does it say that we heard that message, the show was successful, all of your shows? And I think you can argue, and I know you point this out, that shows like Good Times and Jefferson's even had more of a message and a real punch than even All in the Family. And yet, here we are where I believe you have said those shows wouldn't be on the air, wouldn't get on the air now.
Well, I haven't so much as said it myself as reported that I hear from, because I'm not involved in television at the moment, but the showrunners that I know who are involved with many of the shows that are doing so well, they tell me that it wouldn't get on the air today. You know, I have no first-hand experience, but that's what I hear.
What do you make of that?
Well, there were no problems in America.
But how do we go back? I mean, in some ways, if you looked at a character like Archie Bunker, that we would say, okay, well, that character now is not politically correct. Although, I mean, I was, for this interview, I was watching two seasons of the show, and it's as if you're having a conversation about what happened in Ferguson.
Establishment wants to look the other way. You know, we don't have race problems. And so we don't have anybody talking to us. The country needs a father. Now, maybe this comes from my own life where I needed one. And the country needs one. And it doesn't require an elderly person. It could be a man as young as Barack Obama, so long as he talked about the reality of our existence, so long as he asked us as Americans to look in the mirror and see ourselves honestly and see our condition honestly, which would include our racial problems and so forth. And I don't mean that just any president would be terribly successful at that, but any president could be incrementally successful at that. And the rest of the establishment picks up from there. By that, I mean the media. What is the media doing to help? This is a government that designed to depend on an informed citizenry. And what does the media do to inform it? It yells, it screams, it gives bumper stickers. We did a study. There's a center in my name at the University of Southern California that did a study several years ago of how much time the local news in cities across the country gave to local politics in the election period. And it was less than a minute. But let there be a good rape or six people killed in an accident, or that'll make the first 3 minutes of news everywhere.
Norman Lear's new book is Even This I Get to Experience. It is published by the Penguin Press. I can't tell you what a thrill and an honor it is to speak to you and have you as a guest on our program.
Thank you. I can't tell you. Even this I got to experience.
We enjoy hearing from our listeners about the show. You can email us at book@wamc.org. You can listen again to this and find past book shows at wamc.org. Sarah LeDuc produces our program. This off-the-shelf edition was recorded in Manchester Center, Vermont, in partnership with Northshire Bookstore, northshire.com. Bookmark us for next week, and thanks for listening. For The Book Show, I'm Joe Donahue.